Right, welcome back to the F-sharp tutorial part two. Again, thanks Charles for having me here at Channel 9 to record the second part of this tutorial. And so a bit quick recap on what we covered in the first part of the tutorial. Well, we covered the fundamentals, and what we're going to be looking at today is these topics: functional data, a bit of pattern matching, a little bit of imperative and object-oriented programming, and sequence-oriented programming in F-sharp. And these are just examples of just using the basic F-sharp language features to manipulate data and do transformations on data. You'll just learn the basics of how you piece together working with data in F-sharp, and starting to learn how you can translate your object-oriented programming skills and use those in the context of F-sharp as well. First, I want to say, first of all, thank you for coming and watching. And if you've got questions on any of the material today, please do make sure you enter your questions on the Channel 9 website in the forums we have there. Either myself and people from the F-sharp team will be looking at the questions, and we'll be glad to help you answer them. And of course, there's, you know, a big F-sharp community out there who will be more than willing to help you out with getting started with some F-sharp programming. Or if you've just got basic questions about, you know, is the language suitable for doing this kind of work, and, you know, is it a good fit, and should we be looking at it, and so on. We're very keen to make sure that if you take F-sharp and sort of use it in practice in a commercial setting, that you're doing that sensibly. You know, you're using it for the right kind of projects, and not just doing it because, you know, you think it's the latest cool thing or something, but doing it because you're actually going to get a good productivity boost. So have a good think about that, about, you know, when's the right time to be using this language. Make sure you learn the language well, and in a sense have taken it for a bit of a spin before you decide to, you know, use it on projects. Make sure you're matching in your organizations who are looking at adopting F-sharp, make sure you're matching your adoption of the language to sort of the skills you have in your organization as well. It's not just you who's going to have to know F-sharp, it's, you know, other people in your organization, and make sure you kind of work with your colleagues to develop knowledge of the language and to use it in practice. And then you will have a great success, and it's an enormously enjoyable language to use, and a very highly productive language when used for the right kind of problems. So a bit of a recap about what F-sharp is actually about. We're going to be looking just mainly at these first couple of points. This summarizes the tutorial, in a sense, the whole thing. But, you know, what we've looked at so far is we'll see that F-sharp is a general purpose language. You can use it for all sorts of things, but it's a functional first language is a key distinguishing feature. It's efficient, it's succinct, it's got type inference. When you come to use it, it's got this very simple experience of just typing in like let x equal x 1 plus 1, and just like printf when hello world. It's just really simple programs to do the basic things. It's very script-like in its initial experience, but it is strongly typed, and it is .NET, very .NET friendly. We'll get back to these points. We'll cover a bit about object-oriented programming in F-sharp today. But we'll look at asyncs, agents, parallel, and units of measure in the last parts of this tutorial. Just to point out, it is highly interoperable, okay? We've noticed this thing, so some people say maybe coming along to look for math libraries to use with F-sharp. And they'll go to Google or Bing, and they'll type in like F-sharp math library. Just to say, that's not what you type in, okay? What you type in is .NET math library, or C-sharp math library, or VB math library, or something like that, because that'll all be usable from F-sharp, okay? If you're looking for components to use with F-sharp, you've got them. Just look for your .NET components. You'll be able to just use them all straight away from F-sharp. And that's it's a really important kind of conceptual thing when you come to look for the language. Really think of it as a .NET language, and go and use everything you've got in that .NET ecosystem with your as part of your F-sharp programming experience. Okay. And just a little look at the pieces of the language here. We have a functional core to the language, and sort of we have object-oriented programming and this sort of functional data, and that's really a lot of what we'll be looking at today. This core part of the F-sharp programming experience with data, with objects, and with functions. As I said, we'll be covering topics of units of measure. I'm just putting this off to the side a little bit. This is really a core programming experience that we would expect from every kind of F-sharp programmer. These other topics that we'll be looking at, I guess this is a core thing you need to know as well, is about how to do imperative programming, how to do like mutation, how to work with data structures and the like. But these other things where you have async parallel and metaprogramming and queries, we'll just leave those off to the side for later topics in the tutorial. But they're not actually essential. To the essential part of the F-sharp experience is these topics here. You've got to master these before you continue on with your work. So let's take a look at that here. Functional data. So what do we mean by functional data? We really, on the whole, we mean sort of immutable data, and we also just in general we mean treating data more as values than as objects. Okay, obviously everything here is actually implemented using objects under the hood at some level in .NET, but you don't tend to think about that. When you create a list in F-sharp here, we have a list of three different strings here. Of, you can tell I've got children that we've got two kids, and so we kind of these sort of samples are on my mind a lot. So we're creating a data value, a list containing three strings, and it's a value, right? It's like we can't change that list once we have it here. Okay, so it's a simple list here. So now we're going to look at some ways for generating list structured data in F-sharp using this nice feature called sequence expressions or generated data here. So you could also write that by using this technique here. You could actually say yield on these three different strings, and it yields three strings, and you've got a list containing three strings. Okay, it's the same thing here. Okay, and just to say that if you want to generate data, but some of it is kind of conditional, so you start to shape the data that you're generating, then you can also do this here. If the day of the week is a Monday, then we'll yield the baking. Okay, and if not, then we're not doing that. Okay. Now, just to say, we've got this construct called pattern matching. Now, we were looking at pattern matching as a separate topic, but now have a look how we might use it inside as we generate the data. So we have yield some data, we have match on the day of the week, and if it's a Monday, we do this, and if it's a Tuesday, we do this, and otherwise we have these two activities, okay? And then we say, then we've got say goodbye here at the end. So the one data expression here is capturing a range of possibilities for the shapes of the data. And you don't have to kind of create a container and then conditionally put things into it. That's all captured in this one expression here, which is kind of, there's a bit of control in the middle about what we're yielding, and then we have the result. Okay, just to say, you want to put some of these together. You've got the kindergarten activities here, and you want the afternoon activities and the final activities, and that's what's in a weekday. So yield bang here yields another list of data. So let's have a couple of other looks at generating some basic data in F-sharp. So here we have a table of squares. So for each of the numbers from 1.n, so 1.n creates a sequence of the numbers here, then we can yield the number and its square. And so we get a nice generated table of data. And finally, we could take another example. So for each of the children in a sequence of children, we yield something and we yield another set of activities. Okay, so let's go across and take a look at some uses of generating data here. Some simple examples. So the first thing I'm going to do is create ourselves a form in Visual Studio. This is going to be just a form I use to display some data. And we're going to create ourselves a little function which will help us format data up in the screen here. We're going to format the data using this sprintf in 30 columns. And we're going to display it up in the text up here. Right, so now we can just display some simple data. We can take the data, which is a tuple, 1, 2, and we can display that up in the screen, up in the top here. So similarly, we can create some data, the element from 0 to 100 here, and that's a list, and we're showing that list up here. Now, let's take a look at the next list here, the numbers between 0 and 100 stepping by 2 for floating point numbers. And let's take a look at a bit of pipelining here, which we talked about briefly in the last tutorial. And we can take that tuple, like 1, 2, 3, and we can pipe it into the show function here. So they take the tuple and pipe it through the show, and then it comes up here into the screen, into the window. Similarly, say, with the numbers from 0 to 99. Okay, so let's look at some generated data now, the kind we're looking at in this part of the tutorial. So we can take for I in 0 to 99, just to say this, this arrow here is shorthand for do yield, like this. Okay, so we could also write it like this, or we could use the shorthand like this. And we pipe that into the show function, and we get the numbers and their squares here. So we have 3, 9, 4, 16, and so on all the way down. I and I times I. Okay. Now, at this point, you know, let's take a look at this expression here. I had somebody once get confused about what was going on here. They were saying, okay, where is the data being written to? Okay, because I was thinking, okay, we're talking about generating data at each element of this list. And they, yeah, of course, they're in this imperative programming way of thinking about data. But it's not like that. The way to think about this is a value whose elements are generated by through this process. And if you really want to know what happens underneath it, okay, we go through a loop and we create a resize array, a system.collections.generic.list. We fill in the elements and we package it up, and then we get an F-sharp list out at the end. And that, but that's not the way you kind of think of it. You just think of it as a value of generated data, like as a value, a thing that doesn't change over time. Okay, you don't. It's kind of declaratively specifies what it is and what its elements are. Okay, so let's take the numbers and say they're cube here and show those. Okay, so let's take a look at similar process of generation. Obviously, this feature for the C# programmers who are watching is a lot like C# iterators. Okay, the key thing, one key difference is it's an expression form. Okay, so you can use this in the middle of your programming an F# function. So you might say let triangle like this equal this here. We'll make this if I is less than j, then we'll yield the I and the j and the I times j. Okay, so that's the result of the function there. And now we'll take the triangle here and we'll send it across to the show function here. So let's execute this. Highlight it here, and we execute, and you can see the elements that we have over here, starting with zero. The zero I fills in a lot of the elements. Let's swap these around here. Okay. Right. So one aspect that people notice as well is that methodologically, F# programming is pretty different. It'll be a lot of for many problem domains, if you're doing in this exploration mode of F# programming, you'll be taking bits of code and you'll be sort of developing them, and then you'll be starting to write some test cases straight away to make sure that your code here is working. You'll be exploring the results of using various functions immediately in the kind of F# interactive environment. Okay. Rightio. So we'll take a switch back to the to working with generated data over here. Okay. So let's take a look at this next code snippet here. We'll copy this across to Visual Studio in a moment. Oops. Okay. So let's take a look at this one here. So far we've just been playing with numbers, but of course in reality you want to get data from external sources such as your disk drive or the network, from the internet, from a database. And so in this case, let's take a look at a query on your file system effectively. So for each file in the get files on the directory, we're going to yield that file, and then for each subdirectory in the directories, we're going to do a recursive yield of all the files in that subdirectory. Okay, so this is going to work a walk over all the files, starting with this directory. And we're getting a list of all the files underneath that directory. So let's just take a look at this. Okay. So we're using the system IO libraries from .NET here. And we'd better get ourselves a little directory here, like this MIS directory here. And it goes away and it's computing away on all the files underneath this directory, and back they come. Got a few all the various files that were under my miscellaneous directory where I kind of put my some of my work and some of my scripts. Okay. So that's great, except that was eagerly going and immediately working out all those files under that directory. And the problem with that, of course, is that that's not it's not done lazily, not generating data lazily. So you know, laziness is strongly associated with functional programming. F# is a strict functional programming language, like many of the other functional programming languages, OCaml and Scheme and so on. That means when you, if we look over here, let's have a look what that means. That means if we go let A equal let A equal 1 plus 1, for example, it works out 1 plus 1 immediately on the right. A is a value 2, and so it works out that value immediately. And you can actually see that as F# is an impure functional language, so you are allowed to print in the middle of computing an expression. So we can print hello, for example, and then we work out 1 plus 1, and you notice the hello comes out straight away, and then we get the value 2 coming out. All right, so it's a strict functional language. Well, what about laziness? Okay, laziness is an absolutely crucial element of functional programming, and in fact, all programming, doing things on demand, is an absolutely necessary part of programming. So one of the manifestations of laziness in F#, as in .NET and C# in general, is this IEnumerable interface, which is in what we call sequences in F#. So if we look at the sequence version of our code here, so we'll take a copy of this code and bring it across to Visual Studio. We'll delete the old copy, since we don't want to have two functions called all files. Okay, so now we're all set. So instead of producing a list here, we've just changed it around here to generate a on-demand sequence. Okay, so that's been a pretty simple transformation here to take something from being a strict program to being an on-demand program. And again, it's this smoothness of transitions between one mode of expression to the next mode of expression is an essential part of what we're aiming for with F# programming. Transitions, as we've talked about in the first tutorial, part of the tutorial, transitions from scripting through to object-oriented programming, and here transition from some strict data through to some on-demand data. So let's take a look at this here. We'll define our all files function here. And now we can say take all the files under the Windows directory, but we get the first 100 of those here. Okay. And we'll say convert the sequence to a list, for example, and show the first 100 files under the directory, except we probably... We'll just take these first 4 files that are being shown here. I think there was a file that couldn't be accessed for some reason underneath. Okay, so the key thing about this on-demand sequence is that we're not going and evaluating all the files under the Windows directory here. We're just doing the ones that are the first part of the exploration of the yields of these files from this first get files command. We're not at the point where we're exploring the subdirectories just yet. Okay. Okay, so same syntax but generated on demand. Okay. So just to say, if we are generating things on demand, how does that interact with having side effects in your code here? So first of all, if you create some files on demand here, and we've got a print, and then we've got a yield, then a print, then a yield, then a print, and we have some files on demand, then first of all, nothing will happen here because this is a lazy sequence. Nothing will happen initially, and then we when we just have some files on demand, but now when we generate it to a list, then we'll start executing the prints and yielding the values off, and then we'll convert the whole thing to a strict list. We'll have the data in our hands, and the laziness has been eliminated. Okay, so that does nothing, and that does everything, yields everything. Okay, you get some really interesting examples of using sequence expressions to generate streams of data. They're great for queries, and they're also great for sort of infinite streams of data or for streaming data. So here's a random walk where we have an input x, which is some, we assume is some floating point number. We yield that number, and then we adjust it. There isn't a function rnd in the F-sharp library. I assume rnd is just like you've generated a random, using system.random to generate a random number. So now we can recursively yield the rest of the random walk. And when we take this, you'll get a random walk. So let's take this code sample here. Okay. Copy this across. Here we go. And we'll send the, we need to define a random number generator. So we'll do the generator is a system.random. Okay. And we'll just check that that's working. We can do g.next, for example. Okay, that's not quite what we want. We want the next double, okay, which is a random number between 0 and 1. Okay, so that looks good. So we do define the rnd function here to be just the next number in the sequence. Okay, now we can call that rnd. Okay, so we've got some more numbers. And now our random walk function there was working nicely. You'll notice that when this wasn't defined here, we got a nice red squiggly here in the execution of our random walk. Good static type inference, static type checking through your code to immediately tell you the value or constructor rnd is not defined. Right, so we have a random walk here. So let's take a random walk, starting with zero. We'll see if the positives win or the negatives win here. Actually, we'll take and a minus 0.5 here. Okay, because each of these is between zero and one, and we'll have a look to see whether we end up positive or end up negative. Okay. Okay, so now you'll see we've evaluated random walk at 0.0. The default in F-sharp Interactive is to display the first four elements of a sequence. So it does actually evaluate a sequence to the first four elements. Okay. And but we might take a few more of these. We might say take the seq.take the first 100 elements of that, and we'll convert those to a list to make sure we can see them all. Okay. All right, so you see we've taken a random walk and we've ended up negative on this case. And if we do the next one, then we end up, we've gone pretty high, and you can see all the way along, we're sort of usually ending up in the range 0 to 2. Great. Okay. So here's a recap on functional data. We've got ourselves, let's pop this back up. Recap on functional data. We've got range expressions here just to generate numbers. We've got lists here, which can be seen as a query. This can be seen as a query or generated data here. So numbers between 0 and 1,000 and generating a table. We can also generate arrays. Okay, so lists are actually immutable data structure that are linked lists. Arrays are just standard .NET arrays. After you create them, you can actually change the elements in them. But you also just use them as workhorse data structures a lot in F-sharp without actually changing them, treating them as if they could not be changed in F-sharp. And you can do the on-demand version of the same by putting the sequence around the outside. Okay. So in the next part, we're going to look at a slightly different kind of functional data in F-sharp, which is more structured data. And there's two versions of this sort of structured, functional, easy. This is functional data that's particularly easy to define in F-sharp. When you define this kind of data, the F-sharp compiler helps you out a lot with with giving you nice pattern matching over the data, gives you nice display of the data in the Visual Studio Debug visualizer. So let's take a look at this. It's what's called a union type. You can think of this as an enum. It's not actually, strictly speaking, an enum. You can make it into an enum by giving it integer values for each case. But it's a lot like an enum here. We've got a heart, diamond, spade, or club. Okay, nice and simple. And now we're going to model the data that makes up the playing cards here. So we're going to have an ace, and that's going to be the ace of something, or the king, or the queen, or the jack, or a value card, which is going to have a value and a suit as well. Okay, so it's a union type where the cases, it's a what's called a discriminated union type, and the various union cases carry a bit of data with the case here. So let's see how we might generate some of that data to generate a deck of cards here. So first of all, we have our suits, hearts, diamonds, spades, and clubs. And then for each of the suits, we yield the ace of that suit, king, queen, jack. And then for each of the values in 2 to 10, we yield the value card here. And then we've got all the elements of the deck of a deck of cards here. So let's take that example across here. Copy this across. And copy it across here. All right, so we define our suit type, we define our playing card type, we define our suits, hearts, diamonds, spades, and clubs, and then we define our deck of cards here. Okay. And just to check we've got the right list here, deck of cards dot length here. Okay, as we expect, there's 52 cards in the deck. Okay. So just to mention, this data is immutable by default. Now I've got this deck of cards here. It's a list, and each element of that is a list. I can't actually change those elements, but I can use them for many interesting things. I'll use them as inputs to later transformations. Choose a random element in the deck of cards, for example, or build a lookup table of the valuations of the deck of the elements in the deck. So the data is immutable, and that immutability goes through all the way through F-sharp programming. Sort of immutability is the norm for as you declare things in F-sharp. So for instance, you declare a value pi, you can't go and change that value by default. And data is immutable by default. There's the next kind of data is to do with record data here. So this is where you create just simple little records which have a name and a field, and you create elements of values in that record type by creating, for instance, an instance of this object. This is underneath is a class type, and he's creating an instance of that class type. And you can also copy and replace records here. We have an element with the birthday being different, but that's actually copy and update rather than actually modifying this original data. So by default, the objects that you create are immutable as you define new F-sharp types rather than mutation. Okay, I want to talk a bit about the benefits of immutability. A lot of this is to do with parallel programming later on. You know, F-sharp brings various things to parallel programming, but one of them is immutability. And immutable objects can be, there's a certain sense even in non-parallel programming that it just cuts out a huge range of potential bugs in your program, and this means you don't have to think about certain kinds of problems that might arise in aliasing and in making changes to data structures that are already being used for some other purpose. Immutable objects in the parallel side can be transferred between threads just by passing a pointer across, and both threads can continue to use that immutable data as inputs to their algorithms, for example. If a background thread is reporting results back, people often talk about marshalling the data across to the user interface thread. In a sense, that's what you're doing, but it becomes very simple to do that if you're modeling those results, the elements used to report results using immutable data. There's been a huge rise in the importance of immutable data in programming and in computer system design. When you think about HTML that you get back from the website, you're not actually getting a handle to read the data and modify the data on the web server. They give you the HTML. It's a static piece of immutable data when it comes in, and you don't go changing that HTML. You just use it as input to transformations and work that you're doing, and then you send back a result. So this move towards messaging, and you think of the HTML as a sort of as a message to the a result of a request, is a huge factor in the rise in the importance of functional programming in general, and in this case, the importance of just working with immutable data, and just the fact that taking and transforming and outputting data is just a more important part of the programming experience because of the higher connectivity that we have in programming today. So immutable objects can be aliased safely, And they're actually, in terms of optimization, there are kind of different optimizations. There can be more object allocation, of course, but that's the same as when you think about sending the HTML across. There is more allocation and transfer of data in programming today. It can lead to optimization opportunities if you have the same immutable data, as I said, for instance, on two threads, using the same inputs on the two threads, the same data tables, for example. If that data is immutable, then that data can be shared safely between the threads without problem. To wrap up this part of the tutorial, we're going to be looking at a simple example of implementing Blackjack here. We've already been looking at looking at doing some modeling of the deck of cards. So we'll just look at doing some computations over that data. So here's a simple discriminated union, and a discriminated union which holds some data. It's a little bit different in that we're factoring out a card to have a rank, ace, king, queen, jack, value, and so on, separate from its suit. So a card is now a rank and a suit, and we've modeled the rank and the suit using different types. Okay, so we'll take the full deck of cards here. There's a function to generate the full deck of cards. It's very similar to the one we had before, except we've got hearts, diamonds, clubs, spades, jack, queen, king being used on the as in place in the code. So we generate our full deck. We better check that that's full deck dot length here. Okay, we've got to define this one. 52, good. Okay. Right, so now let's define a function which will take the value of a card here. Right, so this is this is this pattern matching construct that we have in F sharp. So it's common to many other functional programming languages and languages like Scala as well. So the input here is going to be a card. Okay, so you normally write that like this, card and so on. Okay. So the difference here is that we know a card always has a particular shape. A card is made up of a rank and a suit. So one way we could have written that is to say, let this equal the card. Decompose the card here on its right using this pattern on the left. And that's going to bind the R and the S variables. Now let's go through and give those decent names here. We change the R variable to be a rank, and we change the suit variable here to be we call it suit. Now, actually, here it doesn't actually matter because the suit variable here is not going to be used in the rest of the computation. So we can actually just put an underscore there because we're just getting the rank out of the card here. Now that we've got the rank, we can say, okay, let's have a look at the different cases here. And this match construct is a simultaneous switch and a decompose here. So let's take a look at this first line, nice and simple. If it's an ace here, then we return 11 for the value of the card. We're going to be implementing blackjack here. And if it's a king, now let's take a look at this next line. If it's a king, a queen, or a jack, then we return 10. We've got three different cases. Now we could, if we wanted, we could write these out separately, okay? Okay, king, queen, and so on. You get the idea, jack. Okay, and they all return the value 10. All right, but it's kind of can be more efficient to say several different cases get covered by the same right-hand side. Here. And finally, we can we've got the value of the card here, like this. We can, with or without the parentheses here, either way is okay. The value of the card is X, and that's going to be the valuation of the card. If it's a 2, it's a 2. If it's a 3, it's a 3. So let's have a look. Just to be clear, these rank here is where the variable gets bound, gets defined according to what part of the card it is. And the X here, the value, is where that variable gets defined, and that lets us use it over here on the right-hand side. Okay, so now we can create ourselves a dictionary here, which is going to tell us the valuations of the cards here. Dict here is a little function which is quite nice for building a lookup table. It'll take any sequence of key value pairs and build us an iDictionary, which will give us a mapping for those elements. Okay, so we can create ourselves a dictionary here. And we say, look up the Queen of Hearts in the dictionary for its value. And we can say, see that the value is a 10 here. Okay, so let's take a hand here. So let's say we've got a hand. Is the Ace of Spades and the Two of Clubs. We take that hand and we're going to evaluate that hand. Well, what we can do is we can take the hand and we can map over an evaluation function to look up the card in the card value dictionary. And then we can sum those elements here. So that's the hand total, which is the sum of those. Oh, this hand is Ace of Spades is 11 and the Two of Clubs is 2. Okay, when we go back and look at this pattern matching up here, an important element about pattern matching is that if a case is missing here, like we're missing the ace case, then we'll get a nice red squiggly here, a nice blue squiggly here, warning, saying incomplete pattern matches. For example, the value ace may indicate a case not covered by the pattern. Just helps you find those bugs in your code about uncovered pattern cases. Another important element is redundancy in the checking. So if we had two cases for ace, one saying 11 and one saying 12 here, then it would tell us that this case is never going to be matched because we've already got ace here. Okay. Rightio. Okay. And this final one here is just calling out the different ways you could name a hand. Describe the hand of the cards. Here are our various cards. If it's got two aces, then it's bullets. This is all the naming for kind of two kings. We call it cowboys, and then so on, three of a kind, and so on for a poker hand. Rightio. Okay. So if you want a sample task to do at home. Then you might think about this one. We'll keep it simple. Aces are always worth 11. We have the same type of cards, and then we're going to and that we had before that you've just seen. Then we have a type of results, and you've got to produce a function which ultimately returns a result here, which would call it. We'll change this result here to be hand type. So you've got to produce. You've got to take some cards coming in and produce something of type hand type. Let's say busted blackjack or hand of int. And take your, you work out the sums of the values of the cards coming in, then work out whether you're busted over 21 or blackjack on 21, or you have a hand of a particular value. Okay. So we'll take a look at the solution to that at the start of the next tutorial. And I think we'll take a bit of a closer look at pattern matching in the next tutorial. And let's just skip ahead here to wind up here. Okay, latest books about F#, put this up at the end of every tutorial you want to know about F#. A lot of these samples we're doing today were originally done by Chris Smith in the Programming F# book. We've got these other great books and the more domain-specific ones like F# for Scientists over here, F# for Technical Computing, and lots of other good material available on the web as well. And thanks very much for listening to this part of the tutorial.